months before, May had called him a moron for building birdie houses. We walked along silently, both of us thinking back to that nightmare when we walked into Hazel's house and she gave me the snake. In the middle of the night, when I was by myself feeding Justin, I had a few new thoughts. My ideas didn't have anything to do with Jesus and savages, I can tell you that much. It came to me that we were nothing more than two human beings, Justin and I. He wasn't so much younger than me, and I was helping him along in life, just as somebody else helped me a while back. We were all supposed to be humans helping each other. I also realized that we three adults were changing. I couldn't see how right then, but I knew it was happening. For one thing, it seems as if Ruby must have wanted to have a son all his life, there in his subconscious brain. He finally saw what it was that could make him happy. He was proud of his family. Anyone could see by the way he acted in church. He walked straight. He always wanted to be the one to carry Justy. And he sang out clearly, as if with song he could celebrate our lives together. I had to hand Justy over the minute we were in public, because he wanted people to know he was the father. I teased Ruby constantly about how he was going to spoil his baby rotten. He used to come in from outside shouting, "Hey, Justy, look at this!" Justy's only about 12 weeks old, and Ruby's showing him a warty toad or a robin's egg. With a baby, you have to look at the world as if someone has just given you a pair of eyes for the first time. When Justy was almost 3 months old, May said we sure were running low on cash. She was ready for me to get off my high horse and get back to work. She reminded me every day that my time was almost up. I knew we were flat broke. I said, "I'm going back in 2 short weeks, Ma. It's in my plan." But I didn't ever want to work at Trim and Tidy again. I wanted to stay home for the rest of my life and have about 10 babies. Here was something I was good at, finally. I was never any good at subjects or sports at school. Besides bowling and dry cleaning, having handsome babies was the job I could do with the hope of success. Artie called me a week earlier than he was supposed to, and said they needed me because they were all getting the flu, not to mention the fact that I was the best spotter in the city. I didn't care about being a sensational spotter anymore, but there wasn't anything I could do about it. May said we had $1.50 in the checking account. I also have the habit of being meek and mild, which is one of the reasons I'm going to inherit the earth, if the Bible is correct. May sat me down at the table and figured it out. We decided we were both going to go part-time. Since I made a higher wage than May, I worked more than she did. She would put in about 15 hours. It didn't bother her to cut back. Artie felt sorry enough for us to give Ruby a job, and Ruby was still the can man every other weekend. At Trim and Tidy, Ruby waited on people at the counter and wrapped up the clothes in plastic like May did. They were both finishers. When Ruby does jobs he's not wild about, he complains a little. I told him he had to support a family now, and that fact shut him up temporarily. We were on a crazy schedule of either coming or going, like bees running off to the hottest flower and then coming back to agitate in a hive. We didn't ever stay put to catch our breath or gather our wits, but there was always someone at home. If I went to work, May and Ruby stayed home, or May solo, and when May worked, it was me, alone or with Ruby. Somehow it came out that Ruby wasn't at home by himself with Justy for more than 2 hours during the week. If I had to point a finger, I'd say May figured it that way, deliberately. The truth is, I'd get jealous of May, When I'd come home, there she always was in the living room, walking around with Justy in her arms. And she never handed him over right away. I had to ask her. I had a stone near my heart, a large, jagged black rock. It was crushing my organs while I watched May kissing Justy on his cheek, saying, "Hush-a-bye, hush-a-bye." I hinted around. I'd say, "I bet it's time to feed Justy." And she'd say, "No, it ain't. I just gave him his formula." I wanted to shout, "I hate formula. I've got what Justy needs right here in my own breasts." I didn't say anything. I stood sulkily, noticing how her pinched-up mouth was smiling for once. The stone would pierce my heart once and then retreat. She was cooing to Justy so tenderly, so I'd say, as quietly and forcefully as I could, "Ma, let me hold him for a little, and then I'll give him back to you, okay?" Sometimes she said pleasing phrases the way Ruby did, such as, "Here's your mama," and then I was satisfied for a while. We were going along, Ma and Ruby and Justy and me, maintaining life. Ruby didn't like the smell at Trim and Tidy much. He said the plastic made him itch. He said Artie gave him a hard time, telling him to shape up every other minute. I prayed that he wouldn't get fired. I actually sat down and prayed to Jesus Christ. There's all those lines in the Bible when Jesus says, "Ask, and it shall be given you." Sometimes a person gets desperate, and they'll try any trick in the book. Dee Dee came over every day without fail. She and May sat in the kitchen drinking gallons of spiked lemonade. Ruby and I stayed in the living room, within earshot of the gossip. We walked Justy around when he was fussy, keeping our eye on the TV shows. Dee Dee always brought me news of Daisy down in Peoria. People kept coming back to the beauty college asking for Daisy, since she was the best student in the entire school. Never failed, her wastebasket had the most hair in it at the end of the day. I guessed she must have given up drinking, because you'd probably cut hair crooked if you were loaded. I missed her eyes with the Martian green lids, and her laugh. She howled at everything. Nothing ever seemed sad to Daisy. Before the baptism, I said to Ruby, "How about making Daisy Justy's godmother?" And he said, "Sure." "You tell Daisy she's Justy's godmother. Okay, Dee Dee?" I hollered into the kitchen. She came and collapsed on the sofa. She said she couldn't imagine Daisy being a god anything, but maybe she was shaping up now. "Dee Dee," I said, "you know your Daisy has a heart of pure gold." "I guess that's true," Dee Dee said, cracking up. "That's why all the men are after her." We chuckled to ourselves over Daisy and what a nice slut she was. Sometimes in the night, I woke up, scared that Justy was dead. Once I sat straight up in my sleep. My heart was broken loose from its regular spot, making its way along my throat. When I opened my eyes, the darkness was thick, like marsh honey. I pawed through the night to Justy's room to make sure he was still breathing. When I got to the door and looked, I was so frightened my chilled blood vessels snapped, and I felt pins stuck on my face. I stood in the door, staring at the huge, unnatural shape in there. I couldn't move my feet. The ogre was making his move to bite off Justin's head, crunch up the skull with tiny, sharp teeth. I almost fell to my knees in prayer. I had no power to scream. There was nothing left but prayer. When I realized it was May, I swore under my breath at her, for standing by the crib, for scaring me to the point of religious conviction. She didn't pay attention. She was hanging over Justy's crib, looking at him, arranging his covers, and taking his thumb out of his mouth. We didn't say one word to each other as we looked at him. He was sleeping, twitching his lips with dreaming. I wished, with my fists clenched, that May would sleep through the night. I turned around and felt back through the dark, back to our room. I couldn't get comfortable. Something didn't feel right. Perhaps it was the stone traveling through my body, making reservations to stay in my heart permanently. May was in Justy's room the whole night, for all I know, whispering, "Say, Grandma." Chapter 16. When Ruby and I were sitting on the couch with our Justy, I told him about Miss Finch's books and the island she went to. They had white sand and calm ocean water, untroubled by dangerous creatures. I only told Ruby about the books where people were happy in the end, such as Great Expectations. In the last scene, when Pip and his girl walked out into the night, the evening mist was coming on, and though the two of them had been busted to pieces, they looked out to the stars, and they were healed by the prospect of the future. I can see us at that moment, our arms around each other, telling stories, while Justy drooled on my lap. There isn't any way around the bad parts unless I lie. Our lives haven't been terrible up until now. I occasionally told myself about how strange I felt as Justy got older, how I didn't feel as if there was a person moving around underneath my skin. I had conversations with myself on the subject of some of the events that had taken place in my 21 years. After a while, all the monologues ending up nowhere, I stopped my thoughts mid-course and said, "This must be what life is. So strange you can't believe it, and a person has to go along with it." I kept saying to myself, "Are you ready for the ride?" I didn't have a choice in the matter, so I held fast, tried to keep my seat. After we all went back to work, after we had been carefree for those initial months, our routine didn't go so smoothly. Ruby and May were home together for the whole day, twice a week. I don't know what materials scientists put in bombs, but it seems as if they wouldn't need anything more than two personalities who don't get along so wonderfully. May wouldn't let Ruby nurture Justy. She had to hold the baby and diaper him and feed him. She didn't let Ruby be the father he dreamed of being. She sent him down to the basement to put the diapers in the washing machine, like it's the glamour job of the century. To her way of thinking, there were millions of things in the environment that weren't healthy for a baby, such as the TV blaring for one, and Ruby not putting enough detergent in the washer. According to May, the diapers came out stinking worse than when they went in. It was true that Ruby didn't have the best method for diapering. If Justy wet his pants, he was wet from his waist down. And May, being how she is, would not let Ruby forget such a travesty. All of a sudden, May was an expert on babies. She had fooled us for years. It's a good thing she's not here to listen to me, because she'd use her four-letter words, and then she'd get on the phone with her best friend, and with tears in her voice, she would say how rotten her whole family was behaving. If it weren't so awful, it'd almost be funny, in a crazy way, like sad clowns dancing at a circus. In the spring evenings, I came in the back door after Artie dropped me off, and I stood quietly in the hall, listening to Ruby and May, and watching. I had an adequate view of the living room, more than I wanted to see, as a matter of fact. I could see May feeding the baby, and I could hear Ruby saying that it was his baby, and that he wanted to feed him now. And May, first looking at Justy, pursing her lips to convey her special love, and then taking time out to glare up at Ruby, would say, "You can't do nothing right, Mr. Can Man. You diaper Justy and he gets a rash up and down his legs. You don't burp him good, and his little stomach ached so terrible. She laughed at Ruby standing around, shifting from his right foot to his left. Justy lay in her arms in his jammies that were way too big, flapping his arms like the wounded blackbird I tried to save once. He flailed around like those wings of his were always going to be crippled. Around about now, I always said, "I'm home." Ruby usually came into the kitchen and sat down at the table. He put his head into his hands. I knew May had called him many names throughout the day while they cared for Justy, terms that are more appropriate for barnyard animals and their urges. She couldn't stand to see Ruby tossing Justy up into the air, especially when she said he drank constantly. As we all knew, she never touched a drop. What made her desperate was the sight of Justy laughing at Ruby's antics. She was fearful. Fearful of losing what she saw as queen mother status. I've seen other fathers throwing their boys around. It's something natural they do. Ruby was careful. I know he was. His gymnastics weren't a major problem. May also despised the dirty animals he brought in to show Justy. And she wasn't crazy about Ruby's consuming interest in TV programs. Sitting directly in front of the set, he never heard a thing, even if the end of the world was being heralded by sirens. He often didn't hear Justy's crying from his crib upstairs. She said it was lucky Ruby wasn't home alone with the baby, because Justy would be found floating face down in a crib full of his own tears. The idea came to me fairly recently that all of May's griping was born from love. But if something so simple as love for a child could be the source of our trials, I'd say it's a cruel joke on Ruby and Justy and me. Call May's predicament love gone haywire, more like it. To confound matters, May didn't know certain rules about human beings. I've got some of them figured out, and I know for certain I've more to learn. The key lesson is trust. If you trust a person, someone like Ruby or me, usually we do a good job. As I said before, we're dying to follow directions perfectly, even for the simple tasks, so we can do remarkably well. May's main point was that since Ruby complained about washing the clothes and taking the garbage out, he didn't deserve to care for Justy. She must have thought he was no older than 15. She acted as if he weren't a grown man or a father. Perhaps her vision was out of kilter, and she couldn't see the stubble on his face. So most often Ruby sat at the kitchen table, his arms around my waist. I stood and he cried into my slacks. "I can't do nothing right," he always said to me. "I'm such a dumb person. I can't even feed my own baby. He gets stomach aches." I whispered to him, "You have a fine brain, Ruby. Don't call yourself dumb. Give yourself some credit." Sometimes I made him a peanut butter sandwich to make him feel a little better. While he ate, I marched into the living room and said to May, "Let me have Justy, it's my turn now." And of course she had to say, "You're not holding him right. Watch out for his head there." Then Ruby and I took Justy outside and played with him in the sand pile Ruby had made for him. We breathed in and out. We kicked dirt and slapped sand. Ruby dug holes in the mountains and watched them collapse. While we were together outdoors, May cooked supper. We could smell the food frying. We could hear her clattering around, setting the table. Justy's favorite entertainment back in June was grasping toys. He loved holding on to common objects and grunting at them. Everything he saw went into his mouth. May was continually yanking things which she thought were far too filthy from his grip. When Ruby and I were alone with the baby, I tried to let Ruby be in charge. Yes, there were a few times when I held my breath, when Ruby tossed Justy high over his head, but there weren't ever any accidents. Ruby knew what he was doing. Justy laughed so hard, so appreciatively. He had a deep belly laugh that sounded like it was coming from an old man who had smoked cigars all his life. When May and I were home together with Justy, it worked out ideally because I was dead tired half the time. I could take a nap if I wanted to, or do the wash. There were buckets filled with dirty diapers, and May was happy to watch her grandson while I dragged the pail down the basement stairs. She was literally happy. About every other day, I had to think to myself, how would I manage without May? I always wondered how I would cope when I would lay down to sleep in the middle of the afternoon, and I could hear her playing with Justy. What would we do if May lived in Texas? May and I didn't know the thoughts that we stored deep in our hearts. We didn't confess our secrets, but we were familiar with each other. Usually I'd forget that she was so bossy. To me, she was only being May. It was when Ruby came home that I had to see her through his eyes. She reminded me of the mother coons protecting their young. If you stumble upon the nest, the mothers look at you like they'd be glad to chew your body into bite-sized pieces. They don't like anyone tampering with their babies. Expert May declared that we should start feeding Justy solid food when he was 8 weeks old, despite the doctor telling me it was too early and unnecessary. He had current facts about how real food prematurely fouled up babies' digestive systems. But May thought she was Mother Earth herself, and she said doctors, with their new theories every 5 minutes, didn't know what they were talking about. She started shoving mashed green beans down Justy's throat, and chicken liver, and canned peaches. She was going to make sure he had the biggest brain in his class. He spat it up, naturally. He knew he wasn't ready for her cooking, that he might not ever be ready. Still, I couldn't figure out how to get May to stop. She was positive Justy needed the extra nutrition. It made me so mad I had to go outside and walk in the woods. I had to observe all the new buds about to burst. The tender young leaves looked like something frail and old, not like something new and vigorous. I had to concentrate on green leaves and flowers to take my mind off certain people and their theories. Once I asked Dee Dee what she thought about feeding Justy solid food, and Dee Dee said May knew the best way, without a doubt. "My kids ain't grade A examples," she said, shaking her head. She didn't help me one single bit. Dee Dee wasn't about to cross her best friend. It didn't matter what I said. When I came in from chores, I could see that May had fed Justy something fried and mashed. I could see the diapers he had spit up on in the clothes hamper. There was one night in June when Ruby didn't come to bed, and finally, at 2 in the morning, I went downstairs. He was sitting in front of the TV, staring. His eyes grew so wide and stayed that way when he watched shows. He was flipping through a book without even looking at the pages. "What are you up to, Ruby?" My tired voice sounded like there were barbs in my throat, catching the words before they came out. He didn't take his eyes off the screen. After a minute, he said, "You know, last Sunday when the Rev was telling about the little boy?" "What little boy?" I asked, making no effort to disguise my irritation. I didn't usually remember the Rev's topics. There were only certain phrases which remained. "The boy who had the devil in him," he said, "and his father wanted Jesus to come take it out. None of the disciples could do it, but then Jesus arrived, and man, that devil got out fast. Jesus can get devils out easy. I just got to find that story in the Bible. I've been searching all night, but I can't find it. I just can't find it. I kneeled down and made Ruby look at me. I said, "That's nothing but a dumb story. Don't think thoughts like that, Ruby. It ain't the kind of thing to dwell on before bedtime. Come to sleep with me." He didn't pay attention. He said, "Baby, I'm watching this show, see? There's this man. He can't do nothing right. He's in a boys' school. You can tell he's letting the devil come in. You watch. He's gonna do something." "It's a trashy movie, Ruby. Turn it off." I didn't have patience with late-night TV. I was so tired. Why didn't people sleep when they were supposed to? He didn't want to leave his movie because he had to see how it worked out. Who was going to get murdered? Ruby's favorite program was the late-night rerun of Bewitched. He liked to see the characters wiggling their noses, and then plates of candy would come right over by their sides. He had knots in his stomach. I know he did, staying up all night to watch programs that aren't healthy. I know he wished he was married to someone like Samantha. He was always saying his belly killed him. I knew it was May driving him into the television. He didn't ever stand up to her. He didn't even call her names anymore. He didn't say that she was 1,000 miles of fart. He cried into my slacks and wanted to live in TV land. Sometimes he was in his chair until the birds started to sing. And then when he went to trim and tidy, he wasn't worth a hot dog. You'd see him in the chair by the register, sound asleep, with his mouth hanging open, drool slipping over the edge of his pouting lips. All he really wanted to do was take Justy for walks, teach him a little something about Honey Creek and the world. A few days after Ruby was trying to find the devil story in the Bible, he came home early from trim and tidy. Summer is a slow time of year because people aren't thinking about getting woolens clean when it's 90 degrees in the shade. Ruby wanted to play with Justy first thing when he walked in the door, because fathers miss their sons desperately when they're out in the workforce. He couldn't stand hearing that Justy was still down for his nap. When I told him, his face fell, and he kicked the chair. He didn't like the news, so he tiptoed up to the baby's room and tickled him gently, trying to wake him up. And of course, Justy started to bawl. Next thing you know, May is storming upstairs. She's wearing a hot pink cotton dress from Goodwill. Makes her look like a lipstick out of its tube. "You hear what you just did?" she yelled. "You're making him cry. Don't you ever use that brain of yours?" They stood at opposite ends of the crib and she hollered, "You woke him up. I bet that's going to put him in a cheerful mood." She didn't mention that screaming and yelling might turn an infant into a deaf apple picker. She scooped up Justy and crooned at him. "Poor baby, poor little Justin. Hush-a-bye, go back to sleep now. That's my boy." I didn't like Ruby waking Justy too much either, but it wasn't worth rocking the boat. There were going to be other naps in Justy's life. It even made me smile a little at first, that Ruby missed Justy so much he couldn't wait to see him. It's natural for parents to be that way. It doesn't mean that Ruby wasn't using his brain, but May had to be nearby, ready to strike if her master plan was in some way altered. She stayed upstairs, cradling Justin. He was all sweaty as a result of flailing his arms and screaming. Ruby walked downstairs. He had to stop every 3 steps because he was thinking to himself. He walked slowly into the kitchen. He stood in the middle of the room for a few minutes, listening to Justy. And then he reached into the dark cupboard. His hands found what they wanted. He held up one of May's quarts of tomato juice and slammed it against the wall. In our life together, there were quite a few objects Ruby pounded into the wall. The jar shattered, The glass went into the darkest corners of the kitchen. All the juice gushed down as if it were angry and flashing its temper. May came down with Justy in her arms. She stopped in her tracks when she saw me sweeping the glass away. She was dumbstruck at the mess. I could tell it was going to take her a few seconds to speak, so I quickly said, "Be quiet," with warning in my tone. She patted Justy harder than she should have while she muttered the phrases of hers. I used to think the one about cocks meant rooster until I learned better. The tomato drip marks were there for days. No one bothered to clean them up. Perhaps we were all afraid they were cursed. When Ruby came in for supper, May had her speech prepared, but I said, "If anyone says one single thing, I'm going to clobber both of you." I couldn't stand the fighting. While we ate, the clanking of our silverware filled the room and covered our silence. We had Justy in his baby seat on the table, so he could watch us and see how adults behaved. Ruby went to his counselor twice a month, and Sherry said time and time again, "Ruby, you have to find a way to move out on your own, with your wife and son." She said he had to get a full-time job that paid better, but he was slow even down at Trim and Tidy. He wasn't the world's greatest employee. She probably told him he should set up a dentist's office. She ignored the fact that he had problems on occasion. He drifted away sometimes. If he was writing up a bill for a customer, he might all of a sudden stop and stare at the poinsettias in the window. Artie got them cheap after Christmas about 7 years ago, and never took them out. Ruby would say later in bed how the plants looked as huge as palm trees, and he couldn't stop staring at the leaves. It was the marijuana he smoked, and the pills he popped. Sherry told him he had to quit taking drugs, and he always said, "Sure, okay, I will." For a while he tried to get me to smoke a joint. He said, "Baby, it's fun. You gotta try it." I had stopped smoking cigarettes because of Justy. I wasn't about to start another bad habit. I wished Ruby could have refrained, but he said it helped him get through his day. I knew if it weren't for me, Artie would have fired him first thing. Ruby said the poinsettias looked gigantic because he wished we could live in California. He told me you can have a house with the ocean in your backyard, and they grow pineapples and lemons in the parks. You can grab them off the vines and stuff them in your pockets. "Girls," he said, "don't wear anything but bikinis, and men don't drive Fords, only 12-cylinder cars that shift like melting chocolate." It didn't take a counselor to figure out that Ruby saw the world on a different scale from other people. Images in his extra-special imagination occurred to him with awful clarity. When he came home from his sessions with Sherry, he always told me what she said. I couldn't help being infuriated with the big old smart counselor who lived in a brick mansion with her husband. He was a car salesman. She didn't have any problems. All she had to do was tell everyone else how to act. How were we going to move out on our own without May to babysit? And Ruby, with drugs, it's as if his brain was spinning into outer space. Matt, in his observatory, probably thought he was discovering another planet. Planet Matt. It's fine for Sherry to say, "Ruby, move away on your own," but she didn't know the details of the situation. I thought I was an expert on the drama, seeing I was stuck in the middle of hostilities, just like people all over the world on television news. I felt as if I had to be the anchor. If I could only try to be a good person and take care of my family, it was going to be okay. The Rev's words came to me when I was confused. "Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted." And of course, "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth." Those sentences always made me feel I could carry on, and someday I was going to get what I deserved. Ruby said in the middle of the hottest July night, "Baby, do you think there's devils in the world getting inside of people?" I was asleep. I said, "I don't know about any of that, Ruby. Don't ask me about devils. I don't like to think about them." I could hear him tossing the rest of the night. I was so tired I could hardly comfort him. But I knew he was worried about demons and how they can take over a human heart. There were the good times that summer, particularly when Daisy came home after she got her beautician's license. She had a real strange haircut. It was short as usual, but it was cut to points in front of her ears, and then in the back it came sharp to the nape of her neck. There was something pointy to the way she looked, as if she were an instrument that could cleave rocks to exact specifications. When she came to our house, she had pajamas for Justy, with a painting of a basset hound on the shirt. She looked at him, picked him up, and shouted, "Hey, everybody, this is my godson!" Then she said he needed a haircut, which cracked us up because Justy didn't have any hair at that stage. She said to me, "I'm going to do a job on you right now, just like I promised all them years ago when I first knew you. I don't break promises. That ain't in my nature." She took her smart leather scissor case out of her purse and sat me down on the kitchen stool. Everyone stood around and watched her do her craft. It was a free show. Daisy said now that she had a college degree, she knew what was best for me and my shape. I have quite a bit of curly hair, which looks like a hedgerow people can't see over. My expert hairdresser thinned it, cut it, and wrapped each strand around an electric stick. Some of the curls unwound a little, so my head became soft and fluffy. Then she put black mud on my face. I loved her firm touch on my cheeks and eyelids, and every now and then her fingers swept across my lips. After she washed the mud off, she put colors on my eyelids, earth tones. She told me brown and rust and some shiny red lip gloss on my mouth. She took me upstairs to the mirror we have in our room. I couldn't find myself in the looking glass. I could not believe I was the girl. I resembled marine fish, with big puckered lips opening and closing right up close to the window of their tank. "Finally, you look like you belong in this century," Daisy said. "I always knew we could turn you into something." Ruby stared blankly at me, and then he said, "Baby, you and me are going to start a rock band. You look just like a drummer should." We sat around that night on the steps and ate pretzels. Daisy told us about Peoria and the girls she worked with. None of them were too crazy about her, because she was the number one star hairstylist. She explained how she was going to fly out to Los Angeles in a little while, after she got some experience. She held Justy the whole time. He had to stare at her. He was your average hot-blooded male already. He was fascinated by those extraterrestrial eyes of hers, plus her large breasts did not pass unnoticed. He patted them so tenderly. There were a few times that summer when Ruby and I were on our own without May. On the weekends, we took Justy down to the lake in Stillwater, where I first met Ruby. On hot days, we took the baby's clothes off and played with him in the water. I had a hand-me-down bikini from Daisy. It was light blue, and it didn't fit me. I always felt as if everyone was looking at my body, the way the bottoms hung on me like extra skin. We lay on the beach from 9 o'clock in the morning until it got cold and dark, and then we came home cooked. We got so tired from all the sunshine. May said how lazy we were to spend the whole day on our backsides, but we were too sleepy to notice her scolding us. We were too hot, too thirsty, too tired that summer to think what a strange family we made, May and Ruby and Justy and me. Chapter 17. On Justy's first birthday, we had a party for him. When he was in bed, our big family, Dee Dee, Randall, and Daisy, came over. Everyone except me played poker. I didn't feel like celebrating. I wanted to think about the year gone by. I wanted to get the time back right after Justy was born and I stayed at home with him. By some trick I had yet to invent, I would command myself and Ruby to sit still on the couch, with our newborn singing our songs, patting each other's knees. We would turn to stone in that attitude. At the birthday party, Randall watched TV. He never tried to brag anymore. He didn't seem to be anything more than an enormous husk made from old yellowing paper. To my surprise, he wasn't eating anything that night. I wondered if he was about to keel over and die from starvation, or if he had lately discovered that food didn't really make him feel happy at all. I put a bowl of peanuts by him and waited until he gave me a feeble smile and dug in. Everyone else was concentrating on their poker cards, so I went upstairs to look at Justy sleeping. There were so many things I wished for him. I hoped that he would never know that evil groups existed in other countries, sneaking and prowling in the mountains and then killing the poor people. I hoped that he would grow up blind to all of our shortcomings and that he would understand and forgive my poisoned thoughts. It seemed both like seconds ago and 1,000 years before that Ruby and I were playing cards in the labor room, and now here was our boy, 1 year old. The days had melted into each other. 12 months of May and Ruby and me watching Justy in his baby seat, watching Justy rise up on his haunches. All the gray space I tried not to think about where we were squabbling with each other. Often one day was no different than the next, except for the outside temperature. I didn't have time to look around and see the seasons, since I was either going to trim and tidy or washing heaps of soiled diapers. When a girl is a teen, and when she first gets married, she thinks having a baby is going to be a real treat all the time, but it isn't true. For the first year, you're so tired the world spins around in front of your face. You feel dizzy, and the sunshine hurts your eyes. I kept saying to myself every 5 minutes, I guess this is what life is. It makes a person so tired. The summer Justy was 1 and a half, I had a brainstorm. I said to Ruby, how about you and me going on a vacation somewhere? I asked Artie if we could take our week in August, and he said, sure, no problem. Then I went to May and blurted out that we, meaning Ruby and I, were going to go on a holiday in August, if she could watch Justin. She looked up in disbelief, as if I had just announced we were moving to Texas to pick grapefruits. Ruby and I needed time alone desperately. The trip was something Sherry suggested. She's not always full of hot air. It was Sherry who insisted we get away. She told Ruby that we needed privacy and that we must take the time to get to know each other. I knew Ruby well enough, but what we needed, I said to myself, was a vacation from the bristles of everyday life. It's only going to be 1 short week, Ma, I said quickly, after I wrapped up the agenda. I had the time broken up into half-day units on paper so she would know when to take Justin to Aunt Daisy's and when she had to be at the cleaners. It was Artie who had suggested I make a chart. There was even a night out for May in my plan. Daisy had promised she would watch Justy so May wouldn't get an overdose. When we come back, you can take a trip, I said to May. It's healthy to get away. It's good for a person. I didn't have any experience with vacations, but Sherry said, you return refreshed. She said you realize how wonderful home is if you can get away now and then. I didn't think I could ever call Honey Creek wonderful, after no matter how long an absence, but I was willing to give it a try. May snorted. She said, I'll go on a cruise by myself. Won't that be dandy? I'll send you the bill from the love boat. Can't you picture it? An old lady getting sick into the swimming pool in the middle of the ocean. No thanks. That don't sound like my idea of a party. Ma, I pleaded, at least you and Dee Dee could go to Rockford for a day of shopping. Anything, just to get away. Sometimes she acted as if taking Justy was a burden she didn't deserve so late in life. She said, go, leave me alone, see what I care. And she heaved a sigh. What surprised me was how May coped now that Justy was in one of his impossible stages. He was all motion, but he didn't have any coordination. He moved like a drunkard. He wanted to get into everything, and if you weren't watching, he demolished the house in no time flat. I went around and moved the breakable knick-knacks to the top shelves, so there weren't valuable objects he could ruin. But it was May who performed continual miracles. She never once lost her patience with him. He was discovering he had his own will, and if he banged on the table with his spoon so you couldn't tolerate the noise, to get a rise out of us, May, with perfect calm, would gently lift him down so he wouldn't do it any more. He'd bang on the floor instead, where it didn't make such a racket, or dent the table. She was a genius sometimes, I swear. I was not prepared for her control, because of the way she used to rant around in my younger days. I had fully expected that she would be an older, meaner version of herself, but all the traces of her former days had vanished. Justy loved to blow out candles, and he and May used to sit at the kitchen table, working at a king-size box of matches. She'd light the candle while Justy stared at the flame, utterly fascinated, and then he'd blow it out. There was a pile of used matchsticks, enough wood to keep us warm all winter, there on the table. May liked to kiss Justy all over, and he didn't squirm too energetically. While she cooked, she had Justy on the floor playing with pots and pans. Over the fried apples sizzling on the stove, she told him the high points of her life story. He licked the floor while she described her favorite doll, but she was in a trance and didn't notice. She spanked him when he was terribly bad, if he whacked her over the head with the bellows. But even then, she wasn't crazy about punishment. She wanted me to be the one who hit him if he was about to stick his head into the hot oven or run out into the road. Her favorite act was taking Justy into town by herself and strutting down the street as if she were a one-person parade and a baby was a novelty no one had ever seen before. May said to me, "All right, go ahead on your vacation." She said it as if she was dragging her feet, but actually, as I knew from my lifelong association with her, she had a huge old chorus line in her heart, lifting up their legs, doing the can-can. I knew she was gleeful about getting rid of us for a week. Up in our room, Ruby said, "Hey, baby, where are we going on our trip?" "We're visiting Aunt Sydney in DeKalb," I said. "And then we're going to Chicago to see the Cubs." I had counted the money in my pig, and I was going to spend every last cent on my husband. Ruby acted as if Chicago was the place he'd always wanted to visit the most. He got up on the bed and started batting and jumping. He was like Justy, loving everything except chores. When I told Justy he could push the button to start the dryer, he had a nervous breakdown brought on by excitement. However, if you asked him to put the toys away, you had to be careful you didn't get a block aimed directly at your rear end. I wrote Aunt Sid and told her that Ruby had a tremendous urge to see a Cubs game, and I wanted to see for myself how millions of people lived in tall buildings. I told her that we were going to stay in a motel in Chicago. It was bound to be the greatest adventure of my lifetime so far, and I was going to believe it only after it had actually happened. I asked her if we could stop at her house for one night on our way. I figured when we ran out of money, after 2 days, we'd sneak home and camp on the lake. Aunt Sid wrote to say that she didn't have her chorus in the summer. She said any time we wanted to come, it would be a pleasure to see us. The real news from Honey Creek that summer was Daisy's marriage. It knocked us all off our stumps. One minute, she's on the loose. The next, she's promising forever, as if she truly understood the meaning of her words. I guess she knew her mind instantly and didn't need to dwell on her past or future life. She met the man when she was cutting his girlfriend's hair at her beauty shop, Sheer Magic. He was waiting for Dolores to hurry up and get done so they could go on a date. Daisy must have done an impressive job shooting the breeze with him. He told Dolores he had a stomachache and couldn't go to the show. Then he called Daisy's shop and asked her out. He felt bad about the whole episode, but he couldn't help it. He had his own business, doing upholstery for people's furniture. He was starting to go bald, although he wasn't much older than Daisy. It seemed as if he saw through her. He saw what a fine person she was underneath the paint on her face. He understood that she was kind and true, down in the core, despite the fact that she had used her wiles to land nearly every male west of the Atlantic Ocean. He said, "I bet you are prettier without that glop on your eyes, Daisy May." And he suggested she take it off. He went wild how great she looked, so she stopped wearing orange mascara and purple and green eyeshadow. She didn't look like she was suffering from gangrene anymore. She switched to a calm pale blue above her eyes. They were a nice couple. You could see they cared for each other. He didn't paw at her or goose her, but on occasion he walked up to her and put his arms around her, and she'd let him stay there, circling her. His name was Bill. He looked like he'd been standing on his own 2 feet since the day of his birth. Probably there wasn't anyone who could knock him down without a struggle. That's not counting his ex-girlfriend, who punched him in the eye. He took it without flinching, because he said he deserved it. I guess Daisy wasn't planning on going to New York City or Los Angeles to work in the television industry after all. For a while, her ambition was to stay at home and make casserole recipes. She didn't even want to go to Sheer Magic. Bill owned a house outside of Stillwater, and she couldn't wait to spend his money to fix it up. She was thinking of going to night classes in interior design. It's as if there's a virus that steals under a girl's skin sometimes and makes her want to be a good wife, even when she wasn't planning on going that route. They got married in our church. She didn't have any bridesmaids. I wished I could have been in her wedding party, but I wasn't mad at her. It didn't hurt my feelings too much. I knew she wanted to keep it simple, that it wasn't personal. It wasn't because of my looks. She didn't invite any of her old boyfriends, so there weren't many people attending. When I asked her, 2 weeks after they got back from the Wisconsin Dells, if she could take care of Justy while we went away on vacation, she said, "Justy's my godson, and he's going to be my little baby guinea pig. What do you bet I want a kid after chasing the moose around for a week?" She took my shoulders and said, "You go and have the greatest time. You deserve a break. No, I take that back. You deserve something fabulous. Don't worry about Justy. He won't miss you one bit." She winked at me. Daisy's so professional at winking. It makes a person feel warm all over. It was the middle of July, 2 weeks until our trip. Although already my nails were bitten to shreds, I could hardly wait to see Aunt Sid. I was going to do all the things I had wanted to do since I was small. Sit at her kitchen table. Look in her closets and see the dresses she gives concerts in. Smell the lilies she probably presses in books after she's worn them on her chest to commemorate each choral concert. On a scorching July day, the type where you feel as if you're pinned under an iron, our plans were changed. Ruby walked across the street in Honey Creek. Don't ask me where he was going. Maybe to church to pray. And he dreamed himself into one of his dazes, where he has to stand still and look at something hard. The thing either looks tremendous or minuscule to him. The gas station once looked shrunk, and he thought he saw little tiny ants getting into puny cars. It wasn't a secret that Ruby took artificial stimulants, although he did it on the sly. I couldn't always be sure when he was on something, but his bloodshot eyes were often a dead giveaway. Ruby had contacts through Hazel, people who gave him bargains on drugs. He could handle life when he was high, except for the times when objects looked so queer, and he had to tell me about his sensational eyesight. On July 18th, Ruby started across the street, and all of a sudden, he had to stop in mid-step to look at the texture of the road. The small asphalt bumps looked like California foothills, and of course, the pickup truck didn't expect him to stop. It rammed into his leg and knocked him over. I stood in the door weeping when the driver delivered Ruby, complete with his freshly mangled leg. I have to tell the truth. I cried not for Ruby, but because I knew our vacation was out of the question. Ruby didn't have to go to the hospital overnight, even though his leg was banged up and out of commission. He could barely make it to the liquor cabinet, May said under her breath. Why didn't they just run him over? We were stuck in July. All the breezes in the world were hovering over Europe and the Virgin Islands. The heat made us feel like screaming and crying at the temperature, but we were too slow and stupid to open our mouths. Ruby spent his time in the living room on the couch with the fan blowing over him, and I brought him iced drinks and lemons. I watched TV with him and his hurt leg. I felt like there wasn't anything left inside of me. I was nothing but eyeballs watching reruns of Hogan's Heroes and Bewitched, F-Troop, and Gilligan's Island. Justy was hot and cranky. I yelled at him for the dumbest reasons. I spanked him for ripping the cover off the TV guide. I told him to shut up repeatedly when he whined. Good mothers aren't supposed to say words of that sort, but I said all the worst profanities, trying to vent my spleen so I wouldn't throw Justy out the window. I was so glad when May came home from work. I was at the end of my rope. After a week, Ruby hobbled around, but the slightest movement wore him out, and he groaned from the living room, from his couch. He didn't want anyone to bother him, except people who were in the mood to serve. He hollered at Justy when Justy got on his nerves. That was about every 3 minutes. One night I couldn't bear it anymore. I called up Daisy to come over and get me. We went to the town lanes like old times, and we played a few games. I let her win a couple. I didn't care about anything. She sat there telling me about her Bill and how great they were getting along, and how she never had met a man before him who she liked as a person to talk to. She said it was fabulous, their relationship. All of a sudden she felt mature, she explained. She knew she was a grown-up woman, not one of them wild girls so crazy for a hunk of flesh. Not, she added, that he ain't sensational on the horizontal. Bill sure saved me from wrecking my life, she said. I bet I would have turned into an old broad like Hazel. She practically pays boys to do it to her. I turned away. I didn't want to hear a word about Hazel, Ruby's former girlfriend. Bill knows about all kinds of information. Daisy was still talking. He teaches me things I never knew about. He's going to teach me how to hunt deer. I mean, how'd I get so lucky? She looked up to the ceiling as if the crumbling plaster was going to answer her, tell her that she deserved heaven on earth. The minute she mentioned the word lucky, I sat down on one of the yellow vinyl chairs they have, and I burst into tears. I put my head on the score table and cried the way I always cry with Daisy, flat out hysterics. I told her how terribly I wanted to visit Aunt Sid and go to the city, and now I couldn't, because Ruby was in bed all day long with his bum leg. It's a miracle she could understand my choking and stuttering. I said I didn't feel like a person anymore. I said that Aunt Sid always made me think there was something good about me through the mail. And imagine how seeing her in real life would make it 1,000,000 times better. Daisy picked up my sweaty hand, looked me in the eye, and said, "Too bad if Ruby can't go along. You take off anyway. You don't need to go all the way to Chicago, but you could visit your aunt for a few days." "What do you mean?" I asked. Sometimes her thoughts were so unusual. I stopped crying instantly. I never went anywhere by myself. I told her that. "Go alone, you big sissy. What are you scared of? Muggers and knifers on the bus?" "No," I lied. My fingers were shaky and wet, even though I got up and put them over the dryer they have for your hands, so you won't sweat into your bowling ball and lose your grip. Daisy kept telling me I should do something for myself, that I had earned a trip. "Besides," she said, "your Aunt Sid don't know Ruby. You wouldn't have been able to have no heart-to-hearts with a man hanging around." I never said nothing, but I thought it was a stupid idea to take Ruby along in the first place. We weren't bowling anymore. We were standing at the line. We didn't hear any other conversations. We didn't notice pins crashing to the floor. "But Daisy," I said, "it's supposed to be our honeymoon." "Jesus," she whispered, smacking her palm to her forehead. "You don't need a honeymoon. You need a break from your kid and your ma and your husband. Everyone needs time off. It don't mean you ain't a prize-winning wife and mother." She said I should go for it. She kept saying, "Go for it," whenever she got the opportunity. When we got home, I banged the screen door for dramatic effect and stood under the light in the kitchen. May was playing solitaire. She had all her aces up. She was having terrific luck. So I said quickly, "Ma, I'm visiting Aunt Sid next week for a few days without Ruby, for a vacation." "No, you ain't," she said, slapping down the King of Hearts. "I'm not going to care for your husband." Daisy stepped out from the shadows and said, "Now look here, May. You'll be at work half the time, and I'll take care of Justy, and Ruby's a grown man. Even though he don't walk like a ballerina, he can take care of himself. I'll get him the things he needs." May had her card in midair. There wasn't anything she could say after the speech, because Daisy is so tall and gorgeous and well-married. She always makes a mess sound easy. There aren't ever any problems for days. If she doesn't like someone, she says, "Go to hell." Then she wipes her hands and walks away. It was the funniest sight when she came down the aisle for her wedding. She looked like a dewdrop with her lowered eyelids and her blush. It seemed as if she couldn't ever have uttered a filthy word or experienced the meaning of one of those words in her life. Ruby was lying on the couch like a recently decorated and blasted apart war hero when I told him my plans. His bum leg hung off the side as if it was just barely connected to his body. "Baby," he said with tears in his voice, "don't leave me." I talked cocky, although it was a charade. There were swarms of moths giving birth right inside my stomach. I said, "Don't be silly, Ruby. It's only for 2 days. You won't even miss me." "My leg hurts me so bad, baby. It's killing me." I stood up. I said, "Well, my staying around ain't going to make it feel better. It'll have to heal on its own. You have to be patient, that's all." I walked out of the room exactly like Daisy does, tossing her head. She wouldn't look back if you paid her $50. That's how I found myself packing one bag for a trip. My first voyage away from home. I caught the Greyhound in Stillwater. Daisy calls those buses metal dogs and has a whole series of metal dog jokes. I was a wreck at first, especially my digestive system. I needed to use the squat box, as Daisy says, every 5 seconds, but I didn't have the courage to walk to the back of the bus. I sat right up front so I could look out the window and observe my movement through the world. Sitting high, you can see the land stretched out flat, as if there's four people at each corner holding a blanket. And all the rows of corn whizzing by, row upon row. It gets going so fast it makes you dizzy, all those rows like bristles on a toothbrush flashing by a person. I got hypnotized thinking about the king-sized teeth that cornrows could brush. DeKalb is 40 miles from Honey Creek, so it didn't take more than an hour to get there. Suddenly the driver was saying into his microphone that he was glad we'd traveled Greyhound, and he hoped we'd come aboard again soon. I said I would, almost out loud. I felt like telling him that my husband was laid up at home with my mother, because he seemed like such a nice man, with a picture of his daughters on the dashboard, along with his bag of peppermints. There was Aunt Sid waving to me as I climbed down the stairs. When I got to her, I dropped my bag, thinking to hug her with all my might. I didn't want to be shy. I had planned to tell her what I thought about her. I imagine there's probably so much quiet where you are when you're cold and dead. You might as well say how crazy you are about people while you have a mouth and teeth and tongue. Before I could get it out, she grabbed my shoulders and stood looking at me from head to toe. She said that I looked lovely, and I should have, because Daisy lent me her wardrobe. I had on a blue and orange and yellow striped cotton skirt, very full it was, and past my knees. My top was a dark blue silky shirt, not actually silk spun from worms. Still, I felt like an advertisement.